the ACCP Postgrads Podcast, a podcast for postgrads by postgrads. My name is Megan Edwards, and I'm a PGY1 resident at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. We will be joined on the show today by Jesse Merlo and Lindsay Davis, and we'll be discussing tips on transitioning practice from resident or fellow to a new practitioner. But before we get started, I would like to provide you all with a little bit of background on our guest today. First, we have Dr. Jesse Merlo, who is an assistant professor at Pacific University School of Pharmacy. Jesse completed her Doctor of Pharmacy degree at St. Louis College of Pharmacy in 2017. She then went on to complete a general postgraduate residency at the West Texas VA in Big Spring, Texas, followed by an ambulatory care and academia-focused residency at Pacific University in Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center. Jesse currently coordinates the pharmacy skills and application curriculum at Pacific University and also teaches the substance abuse, pain management, and pulmonary topics within the Integrated Science and Therapeutics course stream. Her practice site is a local family medicine clinic, Mountain View Medical Center, in which she participates in chronic disease management of a variety of disease states, including hypertension, diabetes, asthma, COPD, anxiety, and depression. Jesse's scholarly interests include holistic admission processes, curricular dieting, and effects of pharmacist-led educational efforts on appropriate prescribing practices. We are also joined today by Dr. Lindsay Davis, who is a member of Pfizer's internal medicine field medical group serving Arizona and New Mexico on behalf of the cardiology and metabolism team. Prior to her work with Pfizer, Lindsay was a professor at Midwestern University College of Pharmacy Glendale from 2010 to 2022, where she continues to serve as an adjunct faculty member. She earned her Doctor of Pharmacy degree in 2003 from the University of Arizona and completed her residency training in 2009 to 2010 in adult acute care at the Phoenix VA Medical Center. Lindsay actively volunteers at a private cardiology practice twice a month, where she facilitates a pharmacist orthostatic intolerance clinic specializing in orthostatic hypotension and postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome under a collaborative practice agreement. She is currently working on her master's degree in strategic leadership through Penn State. Lindsay's scholarly publications are focused on teaching and precepting methods as well as cardiovascular pharmacotherapy. Last but not least, Lindsay remains passionate about empowering and building skills among clinician educators and serves as the strategic lead for the Habits of Preceptors project. So Jesse and Lindsay, welcome to the ACCP Postgrads Podcast. We are super excited to have you and to hear some of the tips you guys have for transitioning from resident or fellow to new practitioner. So I'll start with you, Jesse. What are some tips you have for establishing rapport with colleagues and in the interdisciplinary team as a new practitioner?
Thank you, Megan, for the question. To me, I think the most important thing is just to listen before you jump in head first. My experience in an interdisciplinary team is primarily in the primary care realm. If you're in this setting, it's really easy to come in ready to go with a lot of ideas on the disease states you can manage and how to run your practice. But to establish good relationships with your team, you really have to slow down, listen, and determine what you can do to help the existing operations. When I first joined my current site, there hadn't been a pharmacist there for a while. So to many of the people there, the need of a pharmacist wasn't very apparent. I took that as a challenge to prove myself. I listened closely to the issues the providers would bring up during our weekly meetings. There are a bunch of metrics they're working on achieving. A lot of these metrics were things I couldn't do anything about, but I did notice one week they mentioned statin usage, and I knew that was my in. So I created a handout for the providers that I focused on mechanisms to increase statin tolerance and other ways to increase adherence. And I've continued to do small things like this and put in a little bit of extra effort when I believe I can really positively impact patient care. And since patient care is essential to the mission of my organization, usually that means my efforts are appreciated by the organization. So now I've successfully integrated myself into the team, and the provider team asks me from time to time to make those presentations. I'm no longer just sitting there listening, but to get to that level, I had to first start off by being just a little fly on the wall. Other small ways to establish rapport are just making sure you introduce yourself to everyone on the team. You're not above anyone on the team. Learn the names of all those that are part of the team. And do your best every chance you get. The best way to establish rapport is to prove that you belong, to be there, and can bring value to the team. So always do your very best work in every single situation, even if it's just something that you find to be a very small and minuscule task. I think if you do some of these things, you can quickly earn the respect of your team members and establish yourself as a vital member of the team. And through that, I think you have taken the first major steps into establishing that rapport.
Thank you for providing that advice, Jessica. You definitely come from a unique perspective as someone who kind of started in a clinical practice area where pharmacists weren't yet established. And it sounds like kind of dipping your toe in the water and kind of taking slow steps to gain that trust from the other members of the multi-specialty team is kind of how you approach that. Lindsay, do you have anything to add?
Jessie covered so much. So I agree with everything that she shared. And her experience is very similar to my experience when I joined a private cardiology practice in 2015, and they hadn't had a pharmacist ever in their practice full time. And there was somewhat of confusion on, you know, what are you doing here? Are you a pharmacy technician? Are you going to just provide consultation on medications? Are you delivering the medications to patients? How are you going to help? And sitting back and listening is super important. I also was eager to show off, quote unquote, the things that I felt like I was good at and that I could add value to. You know, I love atrial fibrillation. I love anticoagulation. I love heart failure management. And I wanted to say, let me take over those things. But the reality was, and what was successful to me, is to ask this very key question. What problems do you have and how can I help you solve them? And by doing that, I got some amazing opportunities to initiate a new drug therapy class of ARNI therapy and heart and HFrEF and PCSK9 inhibitors in complex lipid management, such that it became commonplace for the cardiologists to not even start those medications themselves, but say, you really need to see our pharmacist. They can help you with this. So I guess from that, I would say, be present. When it's easy to sit in your office when you don't have a ton of things to do, or easy to just get consumed in your own mind, walk around, introduce yourself to the providers, ask what they're interested in, ask what is something that they would love to do if they had the time to do it, and then fill that gap. I love this quote that says, opportunity is missed by many because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work. If you are willing and have the perseverance to create a collaborative practice and you are there to help the providers, you will be able to accomplish that. I will offer in the show notes that will be provided with this podcast the reference to a paper titled Guidelines for Pharmacists Integrating into Primary Care Teams. It's an article that I've kept near and dear to myself in developing, honing, and refining my relationships with providers. And I think it provides some really thoughtful boots on the ground advice for things to do and conversely things not to do when trying to establish those relationships. I encourage you, if you feel nervous or you're feeling that sense of imposter syndrome, lean in. Know you have everything you need to be successful, and that once the providers recognize that you're accountable and present, they will lean in quite heavily.
That's fantastic advice, Lindsay. And I like how you brought up the concept of imposter syndrome, because I think that's something that a lot of new practitioners probably experience going into a new practice, and looking forward to reading some of the resources that you provide that, like Lindsay said, will be provided in the show notes. So the next question, I'll have you start, Lindsay. What advice do you have for staying up to date on literature guideline recommendations following a residency or fellowship?
So the name of the game is keep reading, keep being open to continuous learning, and spend time as you can going to conferences or attending webinars so that you can continue to deepen in your understanding of patient care. You know, as I've been a pharmacist for going on 21 years now, I recognize that I have more to learn ahead of me than what I already know. And I think it's fascinating, all of the details in the cardiovascular space of what there is to learn. And now I'm being invited by cardiologists that I work with to attend their conferences on echoes and structural heart disease, and collaborating amongst them professionally. One idea that comes to mind is cardio-oncology. I have a cardiologist that I work with that's really trying to lean into the cardio-oncology space, and he's inviting me to meetings where he meets with oncologists to figure out how best to provide interprofessional care. And so being present, I think, is what's most important. Also, make sure that you are applying the things that you've learned on how to learn as you continue in your continuous professional journey process. For instance, say you are a member of an organization and you get their journal in the mail every month. When you get that journal, make a concerted effort to read the table of contents and flag one, two, or more articles that you should read. And prior to reading them, think, what am I hoping to gain with reading this? What questions do I have about this topic? Then proceed in engaged, thoughtful reading, and then do some post-reflection. What are the key lessons learned? What still is unclear to me? How can I implement this? We have to prime our brain, do the learning, and then make sure we're quickly implementing that learning to have it really stick in the long term. So don't forget retrieval of information. Don't forget asking why questions, and keep learning every day and recognize it's a journey, not a destination.
I think that's great advice. I like how you mentioned, you know, developing those habits now of getting that journal in the mail and asking yourself, what do I want to learn from this one article, and developing those habits and continuing those moving forward. Anything that you would like to add, Jessica?
Yes, I definitely agree with all of Lindsay's comments and her commitment to lifelong learning. I do have a couple like small tips and tricks. The first thing is I would advise others to take on students, residents, or any other type of learner. When I have learners with me, I have them present journal clubs, do topic discussions, and that just automatically forces me to review the topics and make sure I'm up to date with any new literature related to the topics. It's always just a learning experience for me, just as much as it is for them. Another thing that I would recommend for new practitioners is to consider getting further certification. So for me, I got my BCACP, and that in itself is really helpful in making me accountable because I do a certain amount of CE related to that certification every month and have a group that I work with to help keep each other accountable on that CE. And the CE itself that's related to BPS is always really high level and challenging. And that has helped me to stay up to date on a variety of topics related to my specialty.
That's interesting that you brought up board certification. I was just talking to a colleague of mine today about that, because we're in the process of thinking about when we're going to be getting board certified in pharmacotherapy. And a more seasoned pharmacist had mentioned that she has kind of a team of pharmacists that they did what kind of you do, keep each other accountable in terms of the keeping up with the CEs and the educations on that. I will start with you on the next question, Jesse. What are some common challenges that new practitioners face, and what advice do you have for navigating those challenges?
Yes, my main thing I wanted to talk about was already brought up, and I knew a lot of people would say something about it, is imposter syndrome, but it's such an important thing. I remember when I first started working independently, I used to think that the physicians I worked with were quizzing me. I remember a physician asking me what I thought was a trick question about metformin renal dosing. And the question was just so easy for me. And it took me weeks later to realize that it was a legit question. And the question was just easy for me because I've had all this training in diabetes and I've had all this training in the actual drugs used to treat diabetes. And it wasn't a simple question for someone who wasn't a pharmacist trained in that area. So I think the imposter syndrome is really real, and it's a big challenge, and it's something that everyone has to individually work through, but just go back and reflect upon all the training that you have and remind yourself about what makes you a integral part of that team, and that's knowing a lot about drugs and disease management. The other thing, it's a little bit different, that I wanted to mention as a challenge was refinding my hobbies. As a resident and an API student, I felt like it was working at site all day, then working on projects all night and part of the weekend, maybe watching some TV to relax. But I had lost a lot of the hobbies that I used to have growing up or throughout college. And so in more recent years, I've been really trying to challenge myself to remember some of those hobbies and make time for them. So I've started cooking, traveling more, even started golfing with some friends, which wasn't a hobby before, but it has been fun to add that to my list of hobbies. And it took me a while, but I'm starting to find that work-life integration, finding it to be a lot easier now that I've taken the time to commit more to those hobbies.
I think that's fantastic advice. Thank you, Jesse. Anything that you would like to add, Lindsay?
I would just say that I want to honor the notion that sometimes you can have a little bit of a feeling of a letdown as you embark into quote unquote the real world, where you're potentially isolated from that academic environment that is consistently stimulating and pushing you forward. And I'd encourage you to really invest in knowing your why. Why did you pursue a degree in pharmacy, and what about being a pharmacist really resonates with you, so that it can serve as a bedrock when you're having some difficult moments. I think that sometimes there can be a mismatch between the training that we receive and the practice that we find ourselves in. And knowing, you know, again, that there is opportunity all around us and that it will take time to get there. I've personally had an amazing, such fortunate career of being able to practice in retail pharmacy, hospital pharmacy, ambulatory care cardiology, academia, now industry. And I know that the grass isn't greener in any of those places. In each of those roles, I had purpose and I had value, and I learned things that I've been able to bring along the way. And you don't have to have the perfect job, which there isn't one anyhow, but you don't have to have the perfect position after you've completed all of your education. Know that you can create that as you move forward, and every opportunity you have and every struggle you face will serve you better, especially if you maintain a growth-oriented mindset.
That's fantastic advice. So the next question, I'll have you start, Lindsay. What resources are available to support transitioning from a postgraduate trainee to a new practitioner?
So my take on this question is perhaps different than one might expect. And that is this notion that you need to know yourself well. And if you know yourself well, you will be successful in anything you do. So I'm suggesting that you spend time building yourself as a leader, as a good thinker, as someone who's self-aware, as someone who's a compassionate and empathetic care provider. And the way that I go about doing that is through reading and discussions. So some things that I would encourage you to lean in would be work like the work of perhaps James Clear on Atomic Habits, knowing that you are what you repeatedly do, and your identity is based on what you showcase to the world. So if you want to be someone who is well-spoken, then you need to practice speaking well and reading and having a good vocabulary. If you want to be someone who's known for being dependable, then you need to consistently be present, even when it's inconvenient. If you want to make sure that you're a really good thinker, you want to lean into concepts on cognitive bias and ways that humans fail in thinking. If you want to be a good leader, then you need to recognize that leadership is lonely, and you need to respect the leaders you have and learn from their perspective as they lead you and you support them as a follower. You also need to recognize the power you have as a role model, even if you aren't serving as a formal preceptor or educator to future colleagues that are in your midst. Knowing the powerful role you play and how other people will view the profession of pharmacy by every action you and our colleagues around us take. And so with that, I would just say be invested in continuous learning in every single direction in every area, and that will serve you well, especially with maintaining your growth and development with opportunities as they present themselves.
Yeah, certainly. Taking advantage of those opportunities that come your way. And like you had mentioned in your previous answer about, you know, kind of reflecting on your why and your purpose behind what you're doing in your practice. And I think that's fantastic advice. Anything to add on that, Jesse?
I love what was said to speak to like resource guides and stuff specifically made for the transition from postgraduate to new practitioner. I think you can find a variety of different resource guides, webinars, networking sessions, this podcast. lots of resources out there specifically related to that transition from resident life to new practitioner life. It's just looking out for them, knowing that they're out there, and then trying to sift through them and find a resource that really speaks to you, because not all of them are going to be helpful for every person. And then I think the other thing I wanted to mention was the resource of having a mentor. It could be someone from school or residency, fellowship, someone at your new job, or maybe someone you connect with through a national mentoring program. Most large pharmacy organizations have them. And I did the ACCP mentoring program when I was a resident, and really connected with my mentor in that program, and was a great resource in helping me determine where I wanted to go in my career post-residency, and continue to be a resource for me after I landed my current position. So I do recommend reaching out and finding a mentor, and as a mentee, making sure that you commit to the program so that you can get the most out of it. Commit to your mentoring relationships and make sure that you can have a relationship that you actually learn from.
Yeah, I think you brought up a good point in terms of finding a mentor. No matter where you're at in your career, you can always have a mentor. I don't think I really realized that until I came into residency, and my current mentor, who's 10 years into practice now, also has a mentor. So just realizing that no matter where you are at in your career, you can always have a mentor to help you through that. My next question is for you, Jesse, or I'll start with you. What are some key differences in roles and responsibilities between being a postgraduate trainee and a new practitioner? I think you had mentioned one earlier about the time. Maybe you have more time for other hobbies. And so looking forward to any other advice you have related to that.
Yeah, I actually stayed at my same site post-residency. And so at first, I didn't really notice that many differences. I was made fairly independent in clinical practice by the end of my PGY2. So I felt basically the same way when looking into patient care in the future. But I started to notice maybe around the second year out that I was no longer being protected as the new employee in academia anymore. And I had to start taking on the responsibility for saying yes and no to things. And I think that was the main big difference I noticed. A lot of the times, even if you don't notice it or see it, your residency program director or other sort of postgraduate training directors will protect you from a lot of the asks from people in your institution and beyond. They also are continuing to check in with you and make sure you're not feeling too overwhelmed. But you may or may not have the same type of support from a supervisor in your career post-training. And so I did have some of this during my first year, but then, like I mentioned before, it really hit me in year two when I had less protected time and I had to really step up and take the responsibility for saying yes and no to things. And you can't say yes to everything, and you have to figure out what you should say no to. So the way that I approached that was really spending time determining what my goals were for my career. And then if I get an ask, I take that ask, determine if that is going to fit into and support the trajectory that I want my career to head into. And if it is, then great. That's a really good reason to say yes. If it's not going to meet my goals, and if it's not a requirement of my position, that's a pretty strong argument to say no to something. So I recommend really sitting down and deciding what your goals are so that you're able to say yes and able to say no to things, which can be very difficult to do, because that was one of the major differences that I noticed when I took on a career.
No, I think that's super interesting. Something that I did not think about, a challenge that I would be faced with as a new practitioner in a couple of years. And so I think something I'll take away from what you just said is, before saying yes, taking that time to really think about if the ask aligns with my goals and whether it's going to help me reach my goals in the end. And so I'm glad you brought that up. Anything that you would add, Lindsay?
I think that another technique you can use, in addition to ensuring that an opportunity meets your goals, is recognizing that you only have so much time to accomplish tasks. And if you take on more than what you're able to sustain, then you will overpromise and underdeliver. And so a technique that was shared with me by a department chair about 10 years ago was the concept of yes if. That you generally want to say yes to every ask that comes your way, but it always has an if. And sometimes that if may end up being a no, but you still said yes. Hear me out for a second. Perhaps someone requests that you do a presentation in a rural part of the US that would require you to travel by two planes and take a bus and have an overnight stay away from your family, meaning that you would miss a family event. That's a really big ask. So the if needs to make sure that that's going to have good payoff. Am I going to meet someone there that is going to really be impacted by what I share? Or is it going to open the door for another opportunity? Or is the honorarium enough to make up the difference for the time that I've spent away? But this technique of yes, if can be a powerful way to move through a conversation. But going back to the bigger question on what are some key differences in roles and responsibilities, I'd like it to wash over you that once you've finished your training and officially entered into your practice, you are fully woven into the cloth of pharmacy and you represent pharmacy as a profession. And I'd like to think that then we want to protect how our profession is viewed. And so being thoughtful about how we speak about the profession in things like social media or with individuals outside the profession or amongst when we talk about other pharmacists in other roles within the profession. Sometimes I feel like pharmacists are working against each other instead of together and recognizing that we all have a common goal of taking care of patients. And our credibility is made when times are tough, not when things are easy. And so I just encourage you to recognize the importance you have that words matter and words can harm and words can heal, and to have a very thoughtful message about how you portray the profession of pharmacy and uphold it in speaking with others about it.
Yeah, certainly. Remembering the oath that we took as a pharmacist and coming back to the concept that the most important thing is taking care of our patients. So the last question I have, I'll start with you, Lindsay. Reflecting back on your experience transitioning into the role of a new practitioner, is there anything you wish you had known or done differently?
Wouldn't take anything back. And I've had a lot of failures and I've had a lot of successes, but certainly my list of failures is far longer than my list of successes. I think that something that I want to share with you is to inspire you to know that there's an abundance of success out there in the world, and there's an abundance of success possible for every single pharmacist. Therefore, don't get concerned when someone else gets a position that maybe you were seeking or has a different opportunity. That doesn't mean you don't have that opportunity. That just means you don't have that opportunity right now. And comparison is the thief of joy. So be thinking about what your full potential looks like and move in that direction. Gratitude reciprocates. So lift each other up, console each other when you have rough times, and know that we're in this together and that we have the amazing opportunity to take care of patients and partner with our interprofessional colleagues to make patients' lives better each and every day.
Awesome. Thank you, Lindsay. Anything you would like to add to that, Jessica?
That was beautifully said. I don't have much to add, but I also share the same sentiments that even though I had some failures, for example, the job search was very complex for me. I had some missed opportunities. I applied too late. I didn't apply to the right portals, but ultimately I ended up in the place that I most wanted to be. And I truly believe everything worked out like it was supposed to. So there will be a bunch of failures in your life, but they don't have to define you. They can actually lead you right to where you need to be.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice and a great note to end on. So that concludes our episode. Thank you so much, Jesse and Lindsay, for sharing your insights into how to successfully navigate the process of transitioning from a postgraduate trainee to a new practitioner. And thank you all for listening to this month's episode of the ACCP Postgrads Podcast, a podcast for postgrads by postgrads. For more episodes and other resident and fellow resources, visit our website at www.accp.com/resfel.
Thank you for listening to an ACCP podcast for residents by residents. Our theme music is titled Jupiter's Smile by the 126ers and is provided through YouTube's free audio library.